Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:45 PM. That is Pacific Summer Time, and today is Friday, May 19th. And of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. This has been quite an eventful week that we have had a considerable amount of debate about whether President Trump should be or will be or could be impeached. And that has tended to dominate in terms of the commentary, and that has in part distracted from what else is going on in the market. But the most important thing, I think, is that the dollar has been pulling back, and pulling back in a rather dynamic manner. That if we look at the dollar index, for example, then it has failed to hold that 100 level. And that was a big psychological level. It represented an area of resistance all the way between 2015 and 2016, and an area of support as recently as January. But it has now quite clearly failed, and the dynamic of the failure is large. It suggests that a retest of the 92.5 area is not beyond the bounds of possibility by any stretch of the imagination. So that would suggest that we are in for a period of dollar weakness. And there is also a certain element of that this is still a risk-on environment, that there is less requirement for a hedge to own the US dollar. And I think that that is also part of the reason why we haven't had a more pronounced reaction by gold this week. It was certainly up. It was up on Wednesday, down a bit yesterday, and up again a bit today. The most important thing that it has done in the last 2 weeks is that it has bounced from above that $1,200 area, so it has held the progression of higher reaction lows since the middle of December. But the more important point is that it has been really quite range-bound for a year and a half already, and that is demonstrating that the price level around between 1100 and 1200 has held, that we are in a period of right-hand extension following the massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend that we saw at the beginning of 2016. And right now, the price is in a rangy, but it is still an uptrend, so it's a rangy uptrend from the lows that we saw back in December. And as long as that progression of higher reaction lows remains intact, we can give the benefit of the doubt to that rangy upside. Platinum, which has bounced from that $900 area, was up a meager amount today, just $3, but it has bounced from that $900 area. Now, the big question is, what's it going to do next? Is it going to be able to extend this advance? That we've had a reasonable bounce from the $900 area, but the progression of lower rally highs is still intact, and it is now testing the region of the trend mean. Is not really not that far away from it either. So next week, the big question will be whether this advance is going to hold. There is a quickly evolving short-term oversold condition developing on the dollar index. So it is not beyond the bounds possibility that we get some pause and consolidation in the dollar after such a persistent decline almost all week next week. But I think that the broader pattern here is for some additional downside, that there is a very clear progression of lower rally highs. And this week was also an interesting week in the oil market. If we can continue to look at it, and then this has been an impressive rebound. There was quite a few short positions, and they have now been pressured, and oil prices continue to rally. And just as there was a short-term oversold condition a couple of weeks ago, that is rapidly morphing into a short-term overbought condition as it comes back up towards where the progression of lower rally highs is. This remains a volatile environment. I'm going to post an article today talking about methane hydrates. And if you caught the very first episode of The New Dallas than they were actually speculating about it. What it really tells us is that there has been that lots of people have known about methane hydrates. They're basically methane gas encapsulated in ice and located at the bottom of the sea under high pressure. And it represents an enormous resource. But it is also a resource that is expensive to exploit. Well, the Chinese and the Japanese have been experimenting with it, and they are producing. But what it also helps to highlight is that there is no shortage of fossil fuels. That I think it was one of the Saudi oil ministers a number of years ago said that the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones, and the oil age will not end because we run out of oil. There is no sensible point in talking about peak oil, but only peak oil at a certain price, and then only with a certain technology, because it is inevitable that the technology will improve enough so that methane hydrates will eventually be economical, and that will represent another large source of additional supply of fossil fuels. So that is off there in the future, but what about now? Well, now we have the primary focus of OPEC's decision to extend their supply cuts has been to try and impact the alacrity with which the onshore domestic unconventional drilling is continuing to increase supply in the U.S. And that's important. That's something that has now created a situation where the U.S. is the swing producer, and it has leached away some of the power that OPEC has, and not least that the U.S. is both the swing producer as well as the largest consumer of energy. So this is going to contribute to a really quite a choppy environment. One of the key characteristics of unconventional oil wells is that they tend to have these very quick but very prolific early stages, and then they peak early, so you have to keep drilling. If you stop drilling, supply starts to contract. So they stop drilling when prices fall, and they start drilling when prices begin to rise again. And there are a significant number of these operations are economic at between $55 and $60. And one of the ways that we can monitor that is to look at the commodities curve. That if we look all the way out to April 19, the price is at $53.52, and July 17 is at $53.70. And in between, there's hardly a dollar of movement, which suggests that there has already been a great deal of hedging, that people are not just happy to sell into the spot market, but that they could sell at today's price for all of this year, all of next year, and into the year after. So that'll tell you that this is a tight market, that in order for prices to move substantially higher, and by that I mean substantially above $60, then we would need to have an additional source of major supply withdrawn from the market. And that at the moment does not look like a particularly likely scenario. So this, I think, is going to remain a whippy and range trading environment. So and another way to think about it is that it doesn't pay up, or it's hard to profit if you pay up for commodities, that they are best bought following reactions, or best sold after they've had a good rally. And oil prices have had a good rally. This rally has not ended, but we are getting back up to a potential area of resistance, so we can't be overly surprised if it starts to encounter resistance within the next couple of weeks. The big question, though, for oil prices is technology, because technology has created this excess supply. But of course, scientists are not just working on how to extract oil. The range of things that that scientists are working on today is really truly mind-boggling, and not least that we are increasingly seeing that people are investing in how to improve battery technology, and the pace of battery technology improving is at about the rate of, so far at least, has been about at about the rate of energy density doubling about every 4.5 years. I was in London earlier this week, and one of the delegates at the tech symposium I was speaking at came up and said that he totally understood that it was a big developing market for batteries because he has land next to one of the UK utilities, and they've approached him to lease it because they want to cover it in batteries. It makes eminent sense for utilities to employ batteries because then they have a much better way, a much cleaner way, and a more efficient way of meeting base load without having to maintain additional power plants just for the few hours in the day when the demand spikes. If they could potentially use less fuel and charge batteries in the low period and run their power plants on a steadier keel, it would require that they would have to have less in redundancy. So that is what's happening. We've already seen a number of utilities going for batteries, and it isn't just a US phenomenon. It is going to happen everywhere because it just makes sense. And as the price of batteries and the energy density of batteries improves, well, then that is just a trend that is going to continue. And we've seen, for example, Tesla announcing that to roof one's house in solar cell tiles, would cost in the region of about $70,000, but that's today. There is something called the Swanson curve, and let me see if I can find a chart of that. And what that is very similar to the very similar to the Moore's law, and what it is that it what it really predicts very clearly is that the cost of photovoltaics will continue to decline. So here I have it from Wikipedia. Let me just pull that over into the main screen, and we have this chart going from 1976 through to 2014, and it is the cost per watt of photovoltaics, and it has continued to decline from $100 down into the cents today. And as long as that continues to decline, that's going to represent a clear growth trajectory for solar. And solar in conjunction with cheaper batteries, well, then that is something that is going to have a clear impact on the energy sector. But batteries alone would have an impact on oil demand, not least from gasoline. It's a really big long-term trend. But the fact that we're going to have a great deal more in computing power in cars, that is something that is going to challenge the employment markets. And I think that that is something that we really have to keep in mind, that because who are the people that are going to be most affected? Well, it's the people that are working today. That w there has been a great deal of talk over the years about generation wars, but there is, and right now we have the US president is 70 years old. He'll be 74 years old if he survives all the way through to the end of his administration, and he wants to run again. And that's a pretty significant age to be in such a high-pressure job. Meanwhile, the most populous demographic in the US is 26 years old. They'll be 30 years old in 4 years' time. And that's generally speaking family formation age. So, and there were statistics out this week that for the first time it was 30-something-year-old women in the US had become the largest demographic for having babies. So people are waiting longer to procreate. But what that also means is that it is usually when people they get to that family formation age and they want to own a home, that they need the additional income to support a family, that's when they get really interested in politics. And then that would suggest that unless the current administration can get its act together and start to really deliver upon the growth-oriented policies that the market has in large part priced in already, then we're going to have a rather difficult environment. Because in 4 years' time, what we're also going to be talking about is the cost of servicing all the debt. And that's a big question. If we look at 10-year treasuries, then what we're presented with is this rangy environment. The yield today is not so far away from where yields were back in 2011. They went up a bit during the taper tantrum, but then they trended lower for the next 3 years, and then we got this big move in yields at the end of 2016, which broke that downtrend. The yield is right now in the region of the trend mean, and the big question is what's going to happen with the stock market. There's been a lot of talk about the kind of risk that risk parity strategies hold for the wider market. There's been a lot of concern about how much money has flowed into the ETF markets. In fact, the total assets under management in ETFs have overtaken the hedge fund industry. So ETFs remain on this just inexorable trend of asset accumulation. At some point, all of that buying will represent a major source of supply. That would be one of the things that would contribute to the next big top. But there's no great deal of evidence to suggest that it's happening right now. The market did have a rather sharp pullback and during the week, and that is what contributed to the tightness in yields over the course of this week. The yield, though, has not yet broken down. It is currently trading around this 2.2 area. It has steadied there over the last few days, and it does have this short-term oversold condition, so we could see some additional pause. But the thing I think that the bond market would rely on most would be additional weakness in stocks would drive yields lower. And as long as stocks remain weak or susceptible to some additional volatility, well, then that will act as a tailwind to the bond markets. But that could likely be temporary. When we look at an index like the S&P 500, it has been trending higher in really a very consistent manner for much of the last year and a half. It was certainly weak this week. It pulled back sharply on Wednesday, and it has recouped part of that, and it didn't hold it on either today or yesterday, but it has improved, and it has now unwound just about all of the decline that we saw on Wednesday. This has been a relatively inert trading environment. That's despite the fact that we had this uptick in the VIX. The VIX had been so incredibly low that it really didn't have many places to go. So it spiked higher on Wednesday, and it has come rattling back down again in here today. It hasn't given up the entire advance, but we see here an inverse mirror image, really, of what we've seen in the stock market. So the progression of lower rally highs on the VIX index remains intact. I think that when we start to think about what are the potential outcomes, well, if we get a break in that progression of lower rally highs by the VIX, then we're going to be into a more corrective environment. That it was easy to get nervous after a big pullback on the S&P during the week, but if we concentrate on the medium term outlook, then this is just a range. It has been ranging for the last few months, and that range has been really quite inert. So it has allowed much of the overbought condition relative to the trend mean to be unwound, and as long as it is trading above the trend mean, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. There are, I think, there are now five big themes that we need to consider. We've talked a little bit about energy, but energy prices are likely to be contained for the foreseeable future. And there is the very realistic possibility that if we divorce our thoughts about energy from oil and think more about electricity, then the potential for prices to come down and for energy to be more available in not just in one country but everywhere, and not just in a centralized location but in as distributed sources of supply, well, then that is potentially a powerful tailwind to economic growth. What we also have is improving governance, and that's quite a statement to make this week, when I think that it would be hard to say that we have improving standards of governance in the USA. That this polarization that we have in the political parties and the just I think that the messy way in which the president is trying to assert his agenda, or not really demonstrating that he has a firm control over his own thoughts or his own agenda, that's not great for sentiment. The fact that this week in Brazil, it's now just about all politicians in Brazil have been indicted in one way, shape, or form, and they are all facing corruption. And it just goes to show you that one of Warren Buffett's truisms is as true today as it ever has been, in that you don't find out who's been swimming naked until the tide goes out. And nobody really cared about taking bribes or paying officials off while the economy was doing spectacularly well. But now that they are combating recession and they have had to introduce fiscal reforms, everyone is rather worried. Temer today said that he had no intention of resigning. And the real strengthened up a little bit after yesterday's really panicky decline. The Brazilian market was down over 10% yesterday. But it was a little bit steadier in here today. That yesterday's a peak for the dollar and a low for the real represents the latest progression of, in a sequence of lower highs since the beginning of 2016. So when we have examples like that, it is difficult to say that governance is improving. But certainly what we do have in Brazil now is a debate going on, and that is at least something that we can look at and say, well, at least there is debate going on, and there is an attempt going on to try and bring some of these people to justice, because you certainly don't have anything like that in there next door in Venezuela, where there is the real prospect of a failure. What we have had in Europe, though, is at least the beginning of a dialogue between the French and the Germans about potentially rewriting the European Constitution to be more democratic. That's certainly a positive. The fact that the UK are getting to vote and to really make a choice on the framework of what their relationship is going to be with the EU, well, that's also a positive. That people are, if at least people have the chance to participate, then the potential for social unrest should decrease. The Indians, India, where we definitely have evidence of improving governance. The rupee has been on really quite an impressive run over much of the last 3 or 4 months, but the RBI intervened today to try and to pull that back. Now, they don't want to have the strongest currency in the world, and it has certainly been heading that way. But there is a lot going on in India, and not least that it offers just a fantastic example of how a large population where you do have improving governance can really capitalize on its demographic dividend. India has much more favorable long-term demographics than a country like China, where birth rates are declining, despite the fact that the one-child policy was abandoned nearly 2 years ago. That it is just it, I think many people, certainly Mrs. Tracy's friends, have concluded that it is just too much trouble to have children, that they really don't feel confident about their ability to raise children and have decided not to have any. That is certainly not the case in India, and there is going to be considerable population growth, but that the population, such as it is today, is young and reaching its peak productive years. The fact that they have been able to employ technology like 4G and skipping straight from 2G to 4G, that means that the productivity of the market is going to be greatly enhanced by putting a smartphone in everybody's hand and making it affordable. Then the potential for online enterprises to flourish in India over the next few years, and not least in the banking sector, well, then that's something that is really a massive transformation. Despite the fact that everybody tends to write off Nigeria, it is a highly populous country, and governance is improving from a remarkably low base. And we're beginning to see just the first signs of some support coming back into that stock market just this week. Then, Africa is where the majority of the population growth is going to come from, and it's imperative that governance begin to improve there. I think we have ample evidence that governance is improving in an increasing number of countries, and not least in Ghana, Botswana, and Ethiopia. But that number needs to increase. I think, by and large, people still tend to think of Africa as a single country rather than a continent, and it probably will take time to change that perception, that nobody thinks of Asia as simply a place, but rather we think of places like China and India and Indonesia as individual countries. So far, I think there is still this way of thinking about Africa as if it were just one single place, and that is just simply not the case. It's a vast continent with greatly differing opportunities, perils, and cultures. But it is also going to be the place where we're going to have the bulk of population growth in the next 20 to 30 years. And that's when we start to have challenges, because governance absolutely needs to improve. And of course, the reality is that it's going to improve in some countries and it's not going to improve in others. And the fact that Africa, with such potential for creating people, and Europe, which has some of the worst demographics of anywhere ever, that the juxtaposition of those two suggests that we are going to continue to have this flow of migrants, that it is not going to stop. That the fact that you can walk from Africa and with only a very short boat ride land yourself within the EU where there are no borders, that is simply an open door for migration, and it is going to be practically impossible to stop. So that is something that is going to both create tensions, it's going to create and it's going to and then it really is a question of how it is going to be greeted, with a sense of economic opportunity and an economic growth, then those people might be welcomed. But the problem is that Europe might now be starting to begin to talk about changing the constitution. But in order to change the constitution, it might have to have a real look at shrinking before it could expand in future. That's certainly a potential outcome, because to change a treaty within the EU requires unanimous ratification, and in some of those countries, not least Ireland, they would require a referendum. So it is an enormous headache to open up negotiations once more within the EU. And there is a there is an additional point when we think about where are we in terms of the political landscape. I think that we simply cannot ignore that there has been an uptick in populism, that we have gone through a period of time where there has been enormous change, and it has been enormous change for large numbers of people. I personally think that the velocity of money chart is one of the most important out there. That velocity of money has been deteriorating since 1997. That this is an index that goes back to 1942. And the velocity of money has never been this low. And it was last updated at the end of March. And part of the reason that it has been so low is because of the of disintermediation. That we have been in a period of time where we have had the internet has allowed whole sections of the economy that previously sustained jobs to simply disappear. And this trend is accelerating. So the velocity of money is deteriorating. The quantity of money that central banks can safely have in the system when velocity of money is trending lower is normal, is larger than would have previously been the case. But that doesn't bring the jobs back. That's something that that's a question that is going to have to be grasped. And probably, Elon Musk is talking about your human brain interfaces. Maybe at some stage, but that's not going to be a 2017 or 2018 solution. The only thing that, and what I find really quite worrying is this penchant that people have for universal basic income. To me, at least, that smacks of of communism. But also I think to quote Margaret Thatcher, eventually you run out of other people's money to spend, which is how she described the problem with socialism. Universal basic income removes the incentive to work. It doesn't enhance the incentive to work. So it is something that is going to be an abject failure. But that doesn't mean it's not going to be employed. The reality is that in an increasingly liberal society, that people will vote for their additional comforts. They will vote for higher pensions. They will vote for higher wages. They'll vote for free education. They'll vote for free healthcare. And eventually, what happens is that eventually you will get to a point where licentiousness, wantonness, and greed have taken over from what would have previously be considered common sense, rational, and conservative ways of managing affairs. So there is the potential that a universal basic income gets to a point where it is implemented, and that even could result in could take the form of a fiscal bump. I think a fiscal bump is the only thing that could potentially get this velocity of money to start to turn around. But again, that is going to have to be targeted very closely at something that is going to create employment and create reinvestment, because there isn't any sign of it right now. And the fact that President Trump, who had held out such had made so many promises, is so far failing to deliver upon them. That's not particularly great news. What it suggests is that companies will continue to do very well. That the Fed might be talking about removing the, or at least reducing the size of its balance sheet. I think we can take a quick look at the balance sheet. They're doing to the balance sheet what the Bank of England did back in 2012 or 2011, if my memory serves me correctly. They are simply reinvesting the coupons. They are reinvesting bonds as they mature, and the size of the balance sheet remains the same at around 4.46 trillion. Now, because the velocity of money is deteriorating so rapidly, there is no prospect of the Fed's balance sheet going back to the $1 trillion mark it was at before 2008, or even indeed the $2 trillion mark it was at after the first quantitative easing program. In fact, I think one of the most important points is that if we look at the history of the Fed's balance sheet, and we can do that. Let me just make sure I'm typing in the right box. And I'm going to look at that on a logarithmic scale. If we go back and look at it over such a very long time, and I'll try and get it to go back before 1997, there isn't a great deal of evidence that they've ever been able to reduce the size of the balance sheet. Now, that's really a challenge, because inflationary pressures are rising. The fact that we have had this declining velocity of money for such a long time, and the fact that so many individual sectors have been disrupted, that has created this disaffection, this massive monetary accommodation, which has been targeted at trying to counterbalance the decline in the velocity of money, has not delivered on growth. What it has delivered is asset price inflation. But asset price inflation favors asset holders over workers to an extraordinary extent. And that also means that average living standards have decreased. One of the clear messages that I noticed from walking around in the UK earlier this week is that most of the talk was about wages. Everybody wants more money. And when you walk around in the US, what people are worried about is wage growth. And that an increasing number of cities, and particularly on the coasts, are voting for much higher minimum wages. That really does set up the potential for inflation to pick up. And that is a large potential outcome. If you have people that are restive and are demanding wages, that is going to create social unrest. And the answer that corporations will have will be to automate further. That will create a greater backlash. So then we have to have a very clear question about how is it that people are going to be employed, because an increasing number of jobs are being automated. One way would be to have local manufacturing. The US, rather than being something that is held up as for its success, it could be looked on as another template, that North America is in many respects self-sufficient. And many countries until now have really focused on exports. But there is, and certainly China is beginning to try and change and trying to develop its internal consumer demand. But if we look at the automation of the manufacturing sector, China is trying its best to get there first. They don't want to lose any more of the export potential that they have to cheaper locales. And it means that population is going to be a very important arbiter of whether self-sufficiency model can work. Obviously, countries need to import, they need to export, but there's going to be an increasing need to balance that out. Any manufacturing facilities that are created in either North America or Europe are going to be highly automated. That's going to require highly skilled workers. It means that education is going to have to increase by an order of magnitude. There was a big drive to enhance living standards by making secondary education free almost 60 years ago. But the reality today is that a secondary education isn't worth the paper it's written on. Even to become a police officer, you need to have a a college degree today. It means that the cost of tertiary education is going to have to decrease if we're going to have any chance at all of maintaining social cohesion and at least the promise of an ability to improve living standards. If we continue to move down the route that we are currently having, then the answer that rest of populations have for corporations that become too powerful is very clear. It's going to be that they break them up. And considering that we now have companies that are growing at exponential rates, are doing fantastically well, are doing big things to help to reduce the cost of living and to improve convenience, then there is no threat of being broken up yet. But at the same time, that isn't something that is perhaps the greatest risk to them out there, that capitalism trends towards concentration, that the strong consume the weak, and eventually that doesn't continue any longer. Eventually, there's no one left to eat, and then what happens? Well, then the company becomes anti-competitive, and that's when you get a revolt. So there is no trend that persists indefinitely, that everything eventually comes to an end. And I think that is perhaps where we're going to have the logical limit to the size of companies. And so I did say that there were five different things, and I think I just want to go over them to ensure that I've covered them all, but that energy prices are likely to come down, that governance needs to be seen to improve. And right now, it is touch and go in a number of countries and then very clearly improving in others. That we have the potential for massive population growth, and that isn't going to happen all in one place, and neither are all the people that come into the world in the next 20 years going to stay in the one place. So there's likely to be really quite a lot of migration, and if you're going to migrate, well, then most people would like to go somewhere nice. And there's a lot of nice places in Europe and a lot of very old people. So I think that migration is going to represent a really quite a social challenge for Europe, not least because the social differences are so very wide. Then we have the innovation that is persisting and accelerating in technology. That is going to be a double-edged sword. There are very clear benefits. We have already seen the enormous benefits in personal productivity and in the quality of our lives that has been delivered by technology. But those benefits have been distributed unequally. And I think that what needs to be delivered is economic growth. That is why I continue to think that the most likely scenario is that we are going to have fiscal stimulus, that we have had synchronized global economic expansion, synchronized global monetary expansion, that we are now coming to the end of that, and that the most likely scenario is that we have synchronized global fiscal expansion. Australia has already gone that way. China is engaged in fiscal stimulus, so is Japan. Europe isn't quite there yet, but it would really only be appear to be a matter of time. The UK is engaged in fiscal stimulus, and the US is currently debating how they are going to get it done. That remains one of perhaps the most bullish points for the stock market. The reality is that we have been through a generational long period where things didn't go particularly well for stocks, and economic growth is now picking up, technology is improving, and this is very clearly a very bullish environment. But I think that when we contrast Amazon, which is an increasingly powerful retailer and services provider that has been on a tear and is certainly susceptible to some mean reversion, not least as it approaches that big psychological 1,000 level. But if we contrast it with Macy's, then we get a very clear picture, because one is trending up in an impressive manner and one is not. So there is, this is, I think, a clear manifestation of the kind of world we are living in today, that there are clear winners and losers. And the problem is that many of the losers are large employers. So wage demands are rising, and what we are now getting is this really quite, you know, if this was a stock market sector, we'd be talking about rotation. And that's what we're getting. We're getting rotation in the labor force. But the shares that are benefiting from the rotation are those that are in the knowledge economy. And the only way that we're going to get more people to prosper is for more people to have the wherewithal to get the knowledge to prosper in a knowledge economy. That's, I think, the clear takeaway. So then if we think about where are we in terms of the cycle, valuations are no longer cheap. And the NASDAQ 100 has broken out of a two-year range. And I look at the NASDAQ because it has been going sideways for 2 years. And that two-year range occurred in the region of the previous peak. And now we have had this clear reassertion on the upside. This has been a very emphatic breakout. Ranges are explosions waiting to happen. We anticipate that they will break out in an emphatic manner, and it has been and remains an emphatic breakout. Eventually, it will move into a more rangy phase, and the question is whether it is going to extend this advance and accelerate first. If the NASDAQ is the leader, well then, the Euro Stoxx Index has been the laggard. It has been really struggling to rally over the last 6 years, and it is only now testing its 2015 highs. That is still significantly below where they were in 2000. That there is the real prospect that this index plays catch up, that the Europeans are engaged in quantitative easing, and they're not going to raise rates really until they can finish with that quantitative easing program. They can't finish the quantitative easing program until they get all of the elections out of the way, they get Brexit out of the way, and they get some kind of debt relief for Greece. So there is little prospect of monetary accommodation being removed from Europe right just yet. So this is an additional, this really does have the potential for additional upside. If we do get inflation, not least because if we are at a point where wages have not gone up for a long time and people are demanding higher wages, well then that is going to create inflation. And a question that has been really at the back of my mind for a number of months now is that Japan did everything to try and to create inflation and failed. And certainly they must have made mistakes, and one of the mistakes they definitely made was not to recapitalize the banks earlier and force them to take write-downs. But what happens if it doesn't matter what they tried, they couldn't have created inflation because we were in one of the greatest disinflationary periods in history? If that's the case and we do get an inflationary outcome, then the potential is that the index that will do best will be Japan, because it is where inflation has been absent for so long that inflation, if it returns, will have the greatest effect. So I think that these are important points, that if we are moving into an inflationary period of time, that stocks generally represent one of the best hedges against inflation, and that we could be in for really quite considerable political turmoil if living standards are not seen to improve. And that does represent really quite the challenge. I think with that, probably talked enough, and I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.